It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another edition of these very special Turned Out of Punk Rock Bowling podcasts. And today, oh my gosh, we got a monster for you. Jake Burns from Stiff Little Fingers, one of my favorite bands ever, one of my favorite vocalists ever, is on the show. And I'm very excited for you to hear this one. If you're looking at the runtime, you're like, how good could it be? It's a good one. Trust me. Stick around. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who is the show producer and the guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeffordDamian. There's a TikTok page, a YouTube page, a Facebook page, and an Instagram page, all for Turned Out of Punk. Those can be found at Turned Out of Punk. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We will be playing some shows. I don't think they've been announced yet, but we will be. And we have some new records. So head over to fuckedup.cc for more information on that. And thank you for doing that. And tell all your friends about this thing. That's how you support this podcast. Tell all your friends about this show. And let them know that we got some good guests on lately. Holy, we are on a streak. And that continues today. As I mentioned off the top, this is one of those special punk rock bowling episodes. And woof, I'm excited to see this band play at Punk Rock Bowling. You heard me talk about it at the beginning of the show in that ad, so I'm not going to repeat myself now. But I will definitely be up front for this band. If you're one of those people that don't like when I ramble in these intros, skip ahead like 2 minutes, because I'm going to ramble here for a second. Stiff Little Fingers are a band that, like, when you get into punk music, you get the whole world laid out before your feet, and you're trying to put all these pieces together, and you're getting all these bands, and you're hearing stuff. You're like, that's great, that's great, that's great. And at least that's what it was like for me. And so I heard Stiff Little Fingers, and I'm like, this is great. You know, but it was just another band as I'm taking this stuff all in. And it's not until a few years later when I guess I'm like 20 at this point, and I went out to visit my girlfriend at the time's family in Vancouver. And they were incredibly nice to me and gave me gifts when I showed up because they knew I liked music. They gave me a couple books about record cover art, as well as the Stiff Little Fingers Peel session. It was actually her uncle that gave it to me. And there's just something about that session that just clicked. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is actually one of my favorite bands ever, Stiff Little Fingers. And sort of ever since that point, I love this band. There's so many good songs. And his voice is just so sick. I can't hear the song Alternative Ulster without getting a lump in my throat. And I'm not Irish at all. It actually has all of it to do with the fact that it's just like a bunch of punk kids, or young kids, just screaming out to be able to do what they're doing. And like literally you can hear them screaming on that song. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. There's a lot I could talk about. Oh my gosh, I could go on forever, but I'm not. So hopefully if you didn't want to hear this, you skipped ahead and now you can sit back. Oh, and I hope I see you all at Punk Rock Bowling. And if I don't, hopefully you get to see a Stiff Little Fingers when they're coming to your town. They've got a bunch of dates announced all throughout May, all the way to August, all over Europe and some on the East Coast as well. So I'll see them at Punk Rock Bowling. Hopefully I'll see you there too. If not, maybe you catch them on the road. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy Jake Burns on Turned Out a Punk. Jake, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Well, as I was kind of trying to force myself not to tell you off air, I'm a huge fan, and this is a big deal for me. And
well, thank you.
Years ago, we were playing, my band was playing a show at Primavera Sound, and I was looking, and you guys were playing later on in the festival, and I was talking to the promoter. And I was like, oh my God, Stiff Little Fingers is playing. That's awesome. And he's looked at me deadpan and goes, of course, they're one of the best bands in the whole world. And you are, you guys are one of the best bands of all time. And so
well, thank you. That's very, very kind of you. Very kind of you.
Well, I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Jake, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the word?
Well, a couple of people, really. The British DJ, John Peel, was the guy who was playing it a lot. This would have been, obviously, 1976, thereabouts. So, obviously, we were growing up in Belfast in Northern Ireland. And there was a lot of unrest going on there at the time. So, bands didn't come and play. So, you were reliant on the radio and on the music papers to keep you up to date. So, Peel was playing a lot. The papers were all, you know, agog about these bands like Sex Pistols, the Ramones, the Damned. And, we had no chance of seeing these guys live. So we were all reliant on sort of secondhand info. As a consequence of which, I was a bit slow off the mark. I was a big fan of people like Dr. Feelgood and Graham Parker, and people who rather unfairly got tagged as pub rock. You know, it sounds, you know, like they got their start playing in bars, but they all had fairly healthy careers afterwards. So, but they were still sort of somewhat demeaned by this tag of, you know, pub rock, like, you know, they never got out of playing the back room of your local bar or whatever. So, you know, I was, because we couldn't see them live or whatever, I was a bit slow off the mark, but Henry Clooney, our guitar player at the time, he really bought into it right from day one. As a consequence of which we were all still living at home with our parents at the time. We were in our teens, you know? And so he kept coming round to my folks' house and dragging all these records by people I'd never heard of and going, you got to listen to this, you got to listen to this, you got to listen to this. And, you know, some of it was great and some of it was terrible, but that's the same with any type of music, you know. So, you know, I was still not really convinced until, excuse me, he kind of left me with the first Damned, the first Ramones and the first Clash album. When I'm not coming back for a week until you listen to these a lot. So he came back after a week and I went, okay, I kind of get it now. And to be honest, it was the Clash were the ones that really, you know, made me see that there was more to it than, you know, basically a 3-minute short, sharp shock, which is, you know, again, to be honest, you know, I was sick of the bands that I'd grown up listening to by that stage, the Black Sabbaths and Deep Purples and people like that. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed those bands when I was 14, 15, but I'd grown tired of the 10-minute guitar solo and stuff. So, you know, it listening to these guys felt like a return to the original sort of roots of rock and roll almost. You know, it was like a 3-minute, 3-chord. You know, no, I hate to use the phrase wham bam, thank you, ma'am, but that was kind of what it was. And you know, it was in there, done. And that was great. You know, I mean, it was interesting. Actually, I became friends in later life with Rory Gallagher. It was like my first guitar hero. And he was telling me that he actually saw the Sex Pistols in San Francisco while he was recording an album. And it inspired him to go back to the studio and just scrap the entire record. And he basically said, you know, as far as he was concerned, that was the closest to seeing Eddie Cochran he was ever going to get. And I think, you know, it showed you that some of the people that were in what was always some disparagingly referred to as the old guard, some of them actually got it, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a continuum. If you follow, there's like threads that go back. Like you brought up, well, a lot of people you brought up right there, like Dr. Feelgood, for example. Yeah. Like to me, that's British proto-punk.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't just, you know, the fact that they did play sort of 3-minute, you know, songs that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was also their stage presence. I mean, there was a sort of, you know, thinly veiled violence about the Feelgoods when you saw them live. And amazingly, they were one of the bands that came and played in Belfast. And, you know, then again, you know, sort of in later life, you know, I was lucky enough to have Lee Brillo, the singer and harmonica player from the Feelgoods, come and play on a record for us, played harmonica on a record for us. And, you know, this just sort of, you know, hugely macho guy you saw on the stage, you know, pumping his fists and stomping up and down the boards, actually turned out to be the sweetest, most erudite, intelligent guy you've ever met in your life. You know,
yeah.
To a degree, anything that you pull off on a stage is an act, you know?
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, it's funny you bring up the toughness and the sort of menace of that band, because you really do see that in the sort of, I've only got to experience them through the live videos.
Right.
But I was reading this sort of account from an NME journalist that was on that, I guess, short sort of run they did when they played Belfast. And he was talking about how intimidated he was. And there's a photo of them in front of a building that's got chain link fences in front of the windows and everything.
Yeah.
And they look a little scared. They look like a little shook and a little out of their element.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Belfast was, I mean, to us, it was completely normal. You know, people have often said, what was it like growing up in Belfast? And it's a bit like, you know, you often hear sort of interviews with, you know, people who've, you know, grown up in, you know, really wealthy families, or people who've grown up even part of royalty, whatever, and say, what was it? Or in fact, actually, I think it was one of the monkeys was famously asked, what was it like being a monkey? And he said, compared to what? Because that was what you knew. And it was the same growing up in Belfast, although the opposite end of the scale, you know. It was there was a lot of unrest about. It was a pretty scary place. Except for us, it was everyday life, you know. And yeah, I mean, famously, the Clash came over and didn't play. They came across, and I believe the story was that they were refused insurance at the very last minute. And I do mean the last minute. It was like 7 o'clock on the evening of the show. But they didn't waste their time there. They went round and stood outside army checkpoints and you know, heavily barricaded police stations, and had their photographs taken and looked every inch the guerrilla warriors, and then scuttled off back to Notting Hill. And you know, that kind of, it didn't necessarily ruin their reputation in Belfast, but it did give us all a bit of a wry smile, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, you know what you know, and it is your reality.
Right. Yeah.
I want to obviously get back to the dawn of punk, but going back before that, there's almost like, there is like sort of a proto-punk thing in Belfast too. When you look at them, like the song Gloria, obviously is a direct punk. And even like the Wheels, like how like wild that band looks, and their, you know, the vocal style of that band. So there is kind of like a precursor to what you guys wind up doing, it seems.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, you know, obviously, again, sort of we were that little bit too young to have caught them and Van when he was starting. But you know, when you go back and listen to those records, and the fact it was interesting as well that, you know, back at a time when everybody was being marketed as lovable, you know, the lovable mop tops and all that stuff, and you had the Rolling Stones who were the antithesis of that. But in the main, bands were, you know, they were marketed basically as safer radio play. And them were always referred to as the angry young them, you know. I guess it's like any industrial town. I mean, Belfast was a shipbuilding town. It was a town of linen mills and you know, pretty heavy industry. They built aircraft there as well. So I guess it's a bit like, you know, probably its closest equivalent would be somewhere like Detroit or something. You know, you're not going to be, it's not some sort of bucolic rural setting. You know, it's very much the opposite of that. And I guess, you know, and again, that was actually the interesting thing about, you know, since I just mentioned the Beatles being the lovable mop tops and the Stones being seen as the antithesis of that. If anything, in real life, the opposite would have been true. You know, I mean, the Stones came from basically leafy London suburbs, and the Beatles grew up in damn Liverpool, for Pete's sake. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think it's always like, it's easier to play that role sometimes than actually live that role.
Right.
But it's interesting you bring up Detroit there too, because you look at where punk starts in America, and it is Detroit and Cleveland, right? So these industrial yeah, wastelands at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense, you know. I mean, there's a great Jake Riviera quote from back in the days when he was managing the Damned, and you know, they also had a journalist on tour with them, and you know, the guy was there for like four or five shows, and some of which were in places like, you know, Middlesbrough, which again is an industrial town in the northeast of England, and others were in Gloucester, which is a nice little market town, and the journalist, you know, pointed out the marked difference between, you know, the reaction in both towns. And Riviera's quote is fantastic. He said, yeah, we go down better in towns where they bolt things together rather than where they grow things. And I mean, I think that's, you know, that kind of sums up the music as well, you know. And even, you know, even though if to leave aside the proto-punk side of things, I mean, Detroit also had, you know, they had the whole Motown thing going on, which, you know, even though it wasn't as hard-edged as something like, you know, Stax was in Memphis, I would imagine that Berry Gordy was a pretty hard-nosed operator to keep that thing afloat, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going back actually for a second to the proto-punk thing, the Wheels, that band, it's wild how the vibe of that band, the way the guy looked, he was like Lemmy's roommate for a while too, on a farm or something. Like,
see, you mentioned this band a couple of times. They're not a band I'm even aware of. So you caught me blindsided there.
Well, I only know it from being a nerd and researching it, but they covered Gloria kind of the same time. I think they had to move to Blackpool in about 64. And I think most of the stuff they were doing was kind of like while they were in Blackpool.
Right. That would make sense.
The lead singer had a shaved head, a goatee, and apparently had a clock or a watch tattooed to the top of his head.
Okay, that's pretty hardcore.
He looks like Anton LaVey.
I was going to say like Rob Halford before Rob, you know.
Yeah. But there is this kind of, I guess, drain that happens with a lot of artists, that because like you said, there's nowhere to play. There's not a lot of, I guess, musical opportunities in terms of labels at this point. So it feels like a lot of the bands left.
Yeah. I mean, that was always seen as the logical step. And also you got to remember that, you know, the Troubles, as they were referred to, because international bands wouldn't come and play there, we were left very much with the local talent. And there was a lot of local talent, but because the original bands weren't coming to play in Northern Ireland, basically the local talent was forced into these things called show bands. And basically what a show band was a live jukebox. I mean, these guys would learn basically the top 20 of the day and go out and play it. And because, like I said, you know, the originals weren't coming to play there. So, you know, folks wanted to hear the songs they heard on the radio. And that stifled local original talent, because, you know, you try to get a show, say, and the people would ask, the first thing a promoter would ask was, what do you play? And we said, well, we write our own material. That was as far as the interview went. You know, the phone would go down, and that was there was no interest in booking you. So that had been the case for a very long time. And there was there was a sort of a burgeoning blues boom in Ireland, same as there was pretty much in the UK around the mid-60s, obviously on the back of the Stones and the likes of John Miles, Bluesbreakers and people like that. And that was, you know, where them obviously, you know, came through, and also where Rory Gallagher came through. I mean, Rory has band Taste at the time, and they based themselves in Belfast because at the time that music was more popular there than it was south of the border. Again, I think probably because Belfast was just that little bit more hard-nosed, you know. So, you know, for the longest period of time, ever basically since that blues boom of the late 60s, when the Troubles started in 69, effectively. So, you know, all the time I was growing up, I was 11 in 1969. So just as the time I was starting to get really interested in all this stuff, it stopped. I remember in 1971, Led Zeppelin came and very famously played in Belfast. I say famously because it was the first time they ever played Stairway to Heaven. And they came and played. And I remember begging my dad to be allowed to go. And, you know, at this stage, the bombing campaigns were pretty much, you know, getting really into full swing. And, you know, there I am, what age would I have been then? 71, I was 13, and begging my dad to go to this show. And he not unreasonably went, "You're not going anywhere." they were one of the very few bands that did come across and play. And it really wasn't until, you know, punk rock came around that bands started writing their own material. I mean, when we started out, we basically, you know, our mindset was so, you know, basically fashioned by what we'd grown up with, that we basically just started, we covered like the entire first Damned album, the entire first Ramones album, and, you know, most of the Clash record. Because you didn't actually, you know, you thought, well, we could try and write our own songs, but who the hell's going to be interested? You know, so there were a number of not just physical hurdles, but mental hurdles you'd overcome as well, you know.
It's interesting because obviously being one of the first capital P punk scenes to emerge, Belfast almost sets this sort of pace for punk showing up in places where the situation is oppositional to youth culture and just like finding a way to exist. And like you said earlier, this is your reality. Like, this is what you've grown up with. I find it fascinating that, like you said, what's referred to as the Troubles sort of ends or doesn't end, but subsides at just the dawn of punk. So it almost feels like all of you were just ready to explode, and it does explode. There's so many fucking incredible bands in that wave.
Yeah, there were a lot of people, all of which just confirmed, you know, what I'd always thought, which was that the talent was always there. It just wasn't being given the chance to shine, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of bloody awful bands as well, but, you know, that's the case with any scene, you know. But the interesting thing was even the bands that weren't that great seemed to, and this, this, you know, has always struck me about the initial sort of, you know, first 2 years or so of punk rock in the UK. And actually to some degree over here in the US as well, but mainly the UK because it was so concentrated, was even the bands that weren't that great seemed to have one great song in them. You know, it's like that old cliche about everyone has a novel in them. It seemed at the time that everybody had one great song. And, you know, even if you never heard of them again, I could probably wander down into my basement now and, you know, pull out at least 20 fantastic singles by bands that I've never heard of since, you know, but that are great, great records. And I think, you know, that was almost like you were being given permission to do it, which was just incredible. It was great.
Well, I think that's like you're saying, everyone's got one great novel in them potentially. And punk was, that's why it's a 7-inch genre, because there's,
yes,
everyone, you got one side of a 45. Everyone can nail that.
Right. You know,
going back to the Highway Stars, did you guys play live at all?
A couple of times. Yeah. I mean, basically that was a school band that, you know, it was where we learned to play effectively. You know, when I was referring to bloody awful bands, we would have definitely fallen into that category. We were terrible. But, you know, we were learning. And I mean, the interesting thing about that as well was, you know, the sky was very much the limit. You know, we really couldn't play that well at all. And yet, you know, I'm standing up the front trying to play like Rory Gallagher. I could barely tune the damn thing. But the fact that we actually felt we could try that and maybe get away with it was, I guess, testament to the confidence of youth, I suppose, or the folly, whatever way you want to think of it. But it was, you know, the very few times we did play, it was certainly a learning experience. I mean, you threw yourself in at the deep end, and when we got, you know, we got a couple of shows in bars in the center of town. And you know, again, had it been anywhere else where people weren't starved of entertainment, we probably would have been lynched and thrown into the streets for being rubbish. But you know, we got away with it. And from that point of view, and you know, punk rock couldn't have happened quickly enough for, you know, for us, because by the time it did, you know, come around and we all, you know, rapidly adopted it as something that we fell in love with. We were in the right spot at the right time, because by that stage we could play well enough to pull that off, but not so well that we sounded like some sort of, you know, Johnny Come Lately charlatans, which we were accused of anyway. But you know, that was, you know,
there's something about punk though, because it can happen anywhere. Like, it doesn't need to be in a proper music hall, it doesn't need to have the best gear,
which was just as well, really.
Yeah. And that's what makes it so awesome. And that's what I think is so great about what happened in Belfast, even if people refer to it as a Come Lately thing, because to me, that's like the scene where people built it under adverse conditions, and it was proof of concept. And that's what today punk still allows for kids to just kind of set up a show wherever they need to.
Yeah, and I think that's also, you know, what I was saying about the strength of the material comes in, because again, you know, much like every form of youth culture that's ever been, the generation that went before basically, you know, derided it as that's not music and I can't hear the words and all that stuff. And yet, you know, here we are talking, you know, 46, 47 years after we formed the band. And we're still playing, a lot of those songs, you know, that I wrote in, you know, my bedroom in my folks' house when I was 18 years old. So it's, you know, there was something there, and there was a lot of talent that, you know, was just itching to be heard, even if it was just like we said earlier, one side of a 7-inch single. They had something to say, effectively, you know.
How important was Caroline music to what was happening for you guys, I guess, prior to what happened?
Yeah. Well, Caroline was, I mean, it was a record store, but I mean, unlike, there were a couple of record stores in Belfast that were sort of, you know, established. There was a very staid one called the Gramophone Shop, which basically, as you can imagine from its name, you know, although it sold rock records and stuff, it basically, you know, its classical section was bigger than anybody else's.
Yeah.
There were a couple of other stores that weren't chain stores, but they, you know, they had a few branches, if you like. And Caroline was almost the first independent that pitched up. And the joy about Caroline was the people who staffed it were actually music fans. You know, you could go in there, and I mean, I actively remember before punk had happened, going in and talking to the guys in there and saying, look, I'm sick to death of all this heavy metal stuff. What have you got that's different but is exciting? And you could actually have that conversation. Whereas a lot of the other stores, you just basically went in, and if you didn't know, you know, what record you wanted to buy, they would, you know, not effectively throw you out the shop, but you know, they didn't have time for you. They were sales assistants, and that was it. The guys in Caroline were music enthusiasts, and that made a huge difference. And that was before. Before I'd even heard of Terry Hooley, and he'd formed Good Vibrations and stuff. So, you know, I think Caroline very unfairly got overlooked in the whole story of what was happening in Belfast at the time, because they were pretty much vitally important, you know?
Yeah, like from what I've understood, like one of the guys from Caroline was also key in getting some of the venues to kind of open up to playing, or like you're saying, non-cover bands finally were allowed to play.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably Kyle. Yeah, I mean, you know, they like I said, they were enthusiastic, and they were also, as it turned out, when bands did start to play there, really, really good people to know, because they were also one of the main ticket agencies for bands. So when the likes of the Feelgoods came over, for example, I mean, they came across, and the week they came over, their album Stupidity went to number one. So, I mean, the show was an instant sellout. But because I'd known these guys for years, and I had a day job at the time, you know, I remember frantically phoning the record store from my day job. And basically going, you will keep me at, and they went, it's okay, we've got your ticket set aside, don't worry. I'll thank God for that. You know, there were other advantages rather than just sort of, hey, you've got to hear this new record by Johnny and the Snot Gobblers or whoever it happened to be, you know, it's like, you know.
So Gordon Blair from Highway Stars goes and joins Rudy after he leaves the band. Were they like, and that's like 75, right? Or 76, maybe? Like,
no, that would have been later. That would have been 70s, late 76, early 77, yeah.
Okay, so just before, I guess, the Rudy single's going to come out.
Yeah. I mean, I think Rudy were the first band to release a single. I'm not, it was either them or the Outcasts of the local bands. They were the first to release a single. But Rudy had been around for a while. Again, I'd never heard of them. The same with the Outcasts. These bands just suddenly seemed to pop up fully formed when punk rock happened. And, I mean, that was interesting as well, because at the time we kind of thought we were the only four people that were listening to this music, you know. And until the night of that Council Clash show, when we turned up and there were like 200 or 300 people milling around outside the venue, we're like, God, all these people know who the Clash are. That's impressive. You know?
Had there been punk shows prior to that? Like, you know, waving the flag type punk shows?
Basically, you know, just the local bands. Yeah. That was, you know, that was when we were, you know, aware of, I think the first show we played at least Brian from Rudy was in the audience. There may have been a couple others, because the show we played was pretty much, it was in their neighborhood. So we were, you know, we're pretty much buying on their doorstep. And, you know, that was when the heckling of each other's bands pretty much started that night, the very first show. You know, so we walked on and played a few songs, and then Brian yelled out to play something by the New York Dolls, of all things. And so, interestingly, I actually knew the guitar riff to the start of Jet Boy and played it. And he luckily went quiet at that point, which was just as well, because that was the only bit of the song I knew.
I guess there's like, it's kind of become stuff of legend that there was sort of this, I don't know, rivalry, or at least sort of distance between Good Vibrations and yourselves. Like, is there a separate kind of scene going on, like more around Caroline music? Because I've heard punks hung around Caroline Records too, and that was like a hotspot. Was there like two scenes kind of happening simultaneously?
No, not really. No, I mean, I think the main reason that the whole, you know, sort of any form of, you know, possibility of a rivalry between ourselves and Good Vibrations came around, basically because we didn't sign to the label. You know, we just stayed independent. And that wasn't even a conscious decision, really. It was just our manager at the time, Gordon, basically said, you know, let's go ahead and press a record. And, you know, Good Vibes had only put out the Rudy single, I think, at that point. So it wasn't like they were, you know, a Motown, since we mentioned Detroit earlier. It wasn't like they were an established label or anything. You know, as far as we knew, they were putting out the Rudy record, and that was it. You know, so, you know, it wasn't like, you know, Terry hadn't built his empire, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, I tended to butt heads with Terry quite a bit, mainly because, well, you know, I was 18, 19 and opinionated, and, you know, he was that little bit older. And, I mean, Terry's never short of voicing an opinion either, even to this day, you know. I mean, so it was just a clash of personalities more than anything else. But, you know, I always had more than a grudge and respect for Terry, not just because of what he ended up doing, but what he'd done in the past. You know, I mean, he'd been, you know, the more you found out about the guy, the more you found out he was quite the mover and shaker back in the day, you know. So he was certainly always, an activist of some sort, you know, and always, to his eternal credit, always, you know, completely an advocate of peace and non-sectarianism through what were really difficult days, you know.
It's also, it seems, like a time old tale in punk that you have people that ultimately are on the same side, but just because we're all stuck together and fight, I guess, fighting for our own turf in this thing, or just not even fighting for our turf, right? Just like holding on to it in our own way, we end up butting heads. And then years later you realize, because Terry's, I read in an interview where he said that you guys were the one that got away. Like, he wishes that was the record. Those were the records he had put out too.
Possibly. And, you know, I mean, it's also true to say that, you know, the record, a lot of the records, not all of them again, but a lot of the records on those early Good Vibrations records, the sound on some of them was fantastic. I mean, again, you know, although Gordon Blair had left us and gone to join Rudy at this point, we had recorded the backing track to Suspect Device. We were supposed to do the whole thing in an afternoon, and I lost my voice, so I had to go back on the Tuesday. We recorded it on the Saturday. I had to go back on the Tuesday and do the vocal. And in the interim, I remember Gordon popping up at my folks' house again with a copy of Big Time, their first single. And I'd already heard our backing track, and I knew what it sounded like. And then he played me Big Time, and I sat there trying not to seethe with jealousy because it sounded fantastic. And so much better than ours. I mean, it was so much more alive. There was a lot more power to it. So, you know, I don't know what magic formula Terry had with a couple of those records. I mean, that and obviously the Undertones' first record that came about later. I mean, those were both fantastic sounding records. And, you know, to this day, I still think that the original recording of Suspect, it's why we re-recorded it for the first album, is because I always felt that the sound of the initial single was so thin. You know, yeah, so there wasn't a, there was an amount of jealousy in terms of the sound and stuff, and but it was very much a friendly and I think a healthy jealousy. It wasn't, you know, sort of I hate them and I hope they all, you know, their truck falls off a bridge into the river or something. It was more, damn, how did they do that and how can we do it? You know, it was more that sort of thing. And you know the fact that you know we would turn up at each other's shows and heckle one another, and then just as likely go to a bar and have a beer afterwards together. So you know it wasn't, you know, it was never a particularly nasty rivalry, you know.
Well, and they and Rudy opened for you at some point, right? I've seen a flyer at least.
Yeah, they have done. They have done a couple of times. Excuse me, or they did do, you know, back in the day a couple of times. But again, that was because, again, so much of, as you'll know yourself, I mean, so much of the music business is luck. And because we were lucky and got the break, you know, and a lot of
Absolutely,
those
but
ones didn't.
yeah, well, I mean, that's right. I meant just sort of that you guys had played together, and so there must be some
Yes,
sort of,
we have.
yeah.
We did, and we used to even back in the, you know, back in the day. And you know, that was actually where a lot of the, you know, a lot of the rivalry would come from. Because the other thing was there was such an outpouring of creativity as well. I mean, not just Rudy, but the Outcasts as well, as I mentioned. And you know, they would have, you know, you'd play with them, and then you know, 2 weeks later, you'd play with them again, or you'd go see them, and suddenly they had four new songs in their set, two of which were like, "Oh, where did that come from?" You know, so you know, that was it was it was it's interesting because at the time, I don't think any of us took the time to stop and breathe and think just how exciting it was at the time. At the time, it was just, you know, oh yeah, they've got a bunch of new songs. You know, I guess we better get our finger out and start writing again. You know, so.
Well, it's interesting because you brought up like the fact that every band has like one good song in them, but there's just all you guys had so many good songs. And say what you will about that first single that you guys did, I think it sounds fucking awesome. And the it is different sounding than the Rudy record, but it does have an immediacy to it that just is, well, I don't know, godly.
Well, again, I think, you know, I think that a lot of those records, again, the Irish ones, as opposed to some of, excuse me, some of the English ones or whatever, where, you know, I think that a lot of the guys who were recording in England were aware that there was a chance that, you know, they could get this record onto an A&R guy's desk, and he might come see them, and they might get the record contract that would, you know, lead to who knows what. From our point of view, trying to get somebody to actually either get on a plane or get on a boat and come across the Irish Sea was daunting enough, but to then come to what was effectively a war zone was really daunting. So I think there was a desperation to those records that was probably missing, and I think that might be what you're hearing when you refer to as an immediacy, was that there was an element of, this is going to be our one chance at this, you know.
And well, like, and like you said, the Outcasts and obviously the other bands you mentioned, but then you like Don't Ring Me Up by Protex, like the Victim single, like the there's just like an unbelievable deluge. Like, it's like, I'd be hard pressed to like look at any other scene in that part of the world around that time and find that many classic singles coming out. Like, it's incredible. Like you said, there's just so much talent that was just, I guess, being held back and just ready to go.
Excuse me. Yeah.
The other band I should have thrown in there was the Star Jets, who you guys played with quite a bit, right?
Yeah. Well, the Star Jets were a year or so ahead of everybody. But they, you know, they were seen very much as a pop band. And they could play. God, they could play. I mean, they were better than anybody, but they'd already moved to London by that point. And they had got a record deal. They had signed to Epic. So, you know, they were way more professional. And I mean, to the point that I remember when we were first starting to play outside of Belfast, and we were just going to play little coastal towns like Portrush and stuff up in the North Coast. And we ended up using the same driver and road guy that the Star Jets had used before they moved to the UK. And I remember Johnny, the driver, asking me about them a lot and said, "Have you ever heard of them?" I said, "No, I've never heard them." And basically, he was bemoaning the fact that we were so disorganized. Like, you're like, those guys are like a military operation, and you guys just sort of shamble in, and you know, you leave. You know, we'd get to the gig and go, "Has anybody got the guitar cables?" "No, we left." "Oh, damn it. Oh, okay. Now what do we do?" And it was, you know, we were not the most together bunch of people. Whereas, you know, they were always being held up as this paragon of virtue. But yeah, when we came to London, we got to know the Star Jets guys mainly through Jim Riley when Jim joined the band, because Jim had grown up in the same neighborhood as those guys and he knew them all. And it was Jim who put them forward as an opening act on one of our early, you know, headline tours. And we loved them, not just as a band, but as people. I mean, they were great, great guys. We're still close. I mean, they played the Belfast, our annual Belfast show with us last year. In fact, I ended up marrying the bass player's sister. There were a lot of connections back in the day.
It also, like you said, they moved to London kind of a year before everything happened. So they were just like, wrong, like right band, but wrong time type thing.
I think actually, and you know, it's one of those things. I mean, I can see exactly why they went. You know, they went there because that was, there's only so much you could do in Northern Ireland before you reached your limit, if you like. So you had to go across the water. It was always referred to as going across the water, and try your luck in the bigger pond. You know, ironically, I think if they'd hung around for one more year, they probably could have been, you know, kings of that thing, you know, really, because they were that good. I mean, they were head and shoulders above in terms of playing above everybody else, and they wrote some great songs. So it was just, you know, like you said, yeah, they were the right band in the right place. They just moved at the wrong time. That was all. Yeah.
It's fascinating how all you guys are obviously not doing the same thing, but like independently are all kind of going in the same directions, but everyone's doing it in such isolation. It seems like,
yeah,
the sounds of it, no one really knew about anyone, but I guess that's because you weren't really allowed to have a scene because of what was happening around you.
Right. I mean, that was the thing, you know, you stayed in your own neighborhood. You know, you very rarely crossed the line. And the other thing, I mean, unlike Derry, where the Undertones are from, the city is very much divided into two halves, or it was back in the day, by the river that ran down the middle of it. You know, so basically, if you were on one side of the river, that was basically, they were all Catholic neighborhoods, and the other side of the river were all Protestant neighborhoods. Belfast was much more like a patchwork quilt. So there were, you know, you could go from one neighborhood to the next and find yourself in, if for want of a better term, enemy territory. That sounds awfully dramatic, but and you could do that. I mean, where I used to work to walk home, I would, you know, cross those lines three or four times on the walk home from work. You know, that would just never happen in other towns. You know, so as a consequence of which, yeah, you tended to stay in your own neighborhood. It was really only the center of the city that was, any sort of, you know, demilitarized zone, if you like. I really shouldn't laugh about it because it wasn't a laughing matter at the time, but, you know.
Well, once again, it's what you grew up with. Like, it's your reality.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely breeds a certain gallows humor, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, like, and once again, not to dwell on it, but they're you know, gangs snatching people off the street, killing people. Like, there's just like,
yeah,
it seems like a very tough place to be in.
Again, you know, we're nothing to compare it to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, moving back to the more universally favorable topic of music, it you mentioned blowing out your voice while recording the first single, and
yeah,
your vocal is a huge influence on not just myself, obviously a lot of people in punk music, but myself. What was the influence on going that hard on the vocal? Because you do have such a vicious attack.
Again, it was people that I liked. You know, we mentioned Lee Brillo. Lee Brillo was a huge influence on that, from Dr. Feelgood. And Strummer, as well. That probably led to it being indecipherable. I probably went a bit too far down the Joe road there. So yeah, those guys. And it seemed like most of the vocalists I liked had that style of voice. And also it was to cover up to a large degree the fact that I couldn't sing. You know, I'd hear these other guys, and I mean, nobody was, with the possible exception of Fergal from the Undertones, nobody was really a gifted vocalist in those bands. So, you know, there were a lot of indistinct voices that were, you know, fighting to stay in tune, but there was nothing, you know, there wasn't a voice you'd hear and go, that, apart from, like I said, you'd hear Fergal Sharkey and go, that's Fergal Sharkey. So there weren't any really distinctive voices. So I guess mine became that just because of the, you know, the sheer volume and gravel in it, really, I suppose. You know, and it's interesting, over years, over the years, I've learned how to sing. So the gravel has pretty much disappeared. I mean, I still throw it in occasionally, but we find that, you know, once we started doing longer tours, it was a bit rough on the old vocal cords to do it every night, you know.
Yes, I can very much attest to that as someone who has not learned to sing, and right. still stuck in the gravel. But that is the like you're saying, a new style of vocal at that point that becomes part of hardcore, screamo. The idea that you're not, because so much of singing properly is about control and about, yeah. You know, and this is about just emoting and giving the audience. Cool. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, the birth of reality music in punk.
I mean, you know, I don't want to make any great claims for it because it came about by accident, you know, and like I said, it was to cover sort of the insufficiency of my voice. So, you know, I'm not going to make any great claims for it. And to be honest, it never really occurred to me until I'm trying to think exactly when I did it, but I've done a couple of tours just with an acoustic guitar opening for the Dropkick Murphys and other bands that they've had with them. And I was talking to one of the guys, I think in Rancid, and he basically said to me, you know, talking about, you know, vocal style, he basically stopped halfway through and said, "Hell, you taught us all how to sing." And I thought, I never really thought of it like that. You never know.
Well, that's the impact of what you, and specifically you guys and yourself, but also like a lot of the bands, but like the immediacy of that and how quickly that went around the world. Like that band Anarchy in Japan is covering you guys like 2 years later.
Yeah, it was interesting. I remember the first, excuse me, God, I'm a real frog in my throat this morning for some reason.
It's that gravelly voice.
It's all that talk of the voice, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I heard a cover of one of our songs. It was a cover of Wasted Life by a band from Finland. And it was John Peel played it. And it was identical and right down to the screaming vocal, but it was in Finnish. When the record came to an end, Peel said, "I have absolutely no idea what they're saying about it." But, you know, and I mean, I remember listening to it again. I was still living at home with my folks. And, you know, to suddenly hear somebody in Finland cover something that I'd written in the bedroom I was sitting in was bizarre beyond belief. You know, it was really bizarre. And then, yeah, like you said, then the cover version started coming, not necessarily thick and fast, but from really unexpected quarters. Probably more is probably a better way to put it. You know,
well, and those. Like that, I think also shows that this is like an international music. Like that's when it's becoming clear that this is something that, and obviously the Beatles were worldwide phenomena, but that there is sort of this like cultural interplay that's happening globally, which you don't really see in many forms of popular Western music, like jazz, I guess maybe you see, I don't know. Actually, I don't know if enough about jazz to even say that about jazz, but like the fact that you have a global punk scene that's just connected by the fact that we all love punk. And that's when it begins.
Well, I think also, to be fair to me, I think it's a, you know, it's an easy music to play, and it's a gateway music. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's something you can pick up. I mean, again, very famously, the Sniffing Glue fanzine posted, shows you my vocabulary changed over the years. Printed a page that had three chord diagrams on it. It just said, here's a chord, here's another one, there's a third, now go form a band. And I mean, that, you know, is any sort of diktat as to how you can start up a punk rock band is as good as it gets, really. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, you find it popping up all over the place, because, you know, kids will always want to, I hope they'll always want to anyway, sort of express themselves through music. And you can suddenly make a half-decent noise pretty quickly and pretty satisfyingly, you know. So, and if that then enables you to express the frustrations you've got inside you, then I'd much rather you did it with a guitar than a rifle, you know. So,
well, I think it's the filmmaker Cocteau said that film was never going to be a true art form till cameras were as cheap as pencils and pieces of paper. I feel like making a band kind of became a true art form when punk showed up, because like you're saying, all you needed were these three chords, and you didn't even need those three chords. You could go up on stage and just bang a chair and yell into a microphone, and, you know, like John Cooper Clark.
I've seen people do that, or something pretty similar. Great. Anything that gets it out, you know, sure.
And it was all valid and important.
If it's important to you and you believe in it, then it's valid, as far as I'm concerned. You know.
Absolutely. Well, how important was John Peel, do you think, to Belfast music kind of getting exposed to the world like that?
Not just Belfast music. Peel is vital. And, you know, you can trace Peel's influence on all the way back to the mid-60s. When he first, I mean, he originally started his broadcasting career actually over here. He started in Dallas, but when he came back to the UK, and particularly when he got the show on Radio One, which was his first national show in the UK. I mean, you know, even back then he was bringing in bands to play sessions. This came from a loophole in the contract that the Musicians Union had with the BBC, where they had a thing called needle time, where they were only allowed to play a certain number of records. And then they had to have live sessions there. So there was a BBC radio orchestra. And it was designed because back when the contracts were all struck, the majority of top-selling records were vocal artists backed by an orchestra. And it was designed so that the musicians in the orchestra would get the extra work. So to get around this needle time restriction, the BBC had its own orchestra and all that sort of stuff. And they would, you know, play live inserts into every radio program. Well, Peel and DJs like him realized there's no reason why it has to be the BBC orchestra. We can get Pink Floyd in. And they did. And so then the Peel sessions were born, basically, you know, to give these bands an outlet. And so Peel had been, you know, he'd been vital, like I said, from Pink Floyd through, you know, Led Zeppelin, T-Rex, David Bowie, all these people. And he always seemed to be one step ahead. I don't know. I mean, I worked at Radio One for a year and I saw Peel's office and it was just mayhem. I mean, it was just the floor to the ceiling with demo tapes from bands and records. I mean, it kind of overflowed out into the corridor. So, you know, I was about to say, I don't know who does his research, but I do. It was Peel did his research, and Peel did it all himself. And he always seemed to be just one step ahead of, you know, he seemed to know what was coming around the bend before anybody else did. And as a consequence of which, you know, you heard a lot of exciting stuff on there. You also heard a lot of almost unlistenable stuff, because he was, you know, he was always willing to take a risk. And it also, as he would openly admitted himself, he often played records at the wrong speed and stuff because, you know, he was a bit slapdash at times. there's an hilarious story of, I think it's Brian Eno, hearing one of his albums being played, and it's being played at the wrong speed. And so he phones the switchboard as this is going out live. And Peel was on late at night. He started at 10 o'clock at night. So he gets this tired, uninterested switchboard operator and says, "I need to talk to John Peel." And he said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Peel's on the air." He said, "I know that. My name's Brian Eno, and he's playing my record at the moment, but he's playing at the wrong speed." Whereupon the operator said, "Oh, they all say that," and hung up on him.
There's a few people that had that kind of impact, not just where the BBC is being broadcast to, I think globally, because of those Peel sessions, like John Peel had on underground music.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, it goes back to the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so, you know, I'd long argued that Peel was probably the single most important figure in British music from the 60s through, you know, leaving aside the bands, obviously. But, you know, it just as a, it's a terrible phrase, and I know that he would have hated it, but to refer to him as an arbiter of taste is actually not too far off the mark, you know?
Yeah. I remember, do you know Sean Forbes from Rough Trade? He was in Hard Skin and
No, this would have been long after our time.
Yeah.
Rough Trade, you know.
When John Peel passed away, he had this list of the records that John Peel left to the BBC in this record box. And it just became my want list. I was like, I gotta find this somewhere. Like these records are all gold, because like you're saying, like, even though he probably would have hated hearing it, but he had an incredible ear, especially for punk, like the stuff that he played on that show and the importance of the stuff he played on that show. It's just like, I'm forever grateful to him. I wish I got to meet him to tell him.
Yeah. I mean, he was actually a very shy guy. I mean, like a lot of people, you know, it's like for somebody that was that important, I think because the music was important to him, sort of the cult of personality didn't interest him at all, from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
But he also, I mean, he was very much an enthusiast, and he wasn't shy to use an Irish expression, he wasn't backward in coming forward at times. And the very first time I met him was actually in Rough Trade. It was in the shop, and he was wearing a Ruts button, and the Ruts at the time had just put their first single out. And I think we had only released two singles, and we were about to record the album, or we just recorded it, but we hadn't released it yet, the first album. And so we had two singles out, and they had one. And he pointed at the button and said to me, he said, "Have you heard of these people?" And I said, "Yeah, I've heard the single." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I think they're the next Stiff Little Fingers." And I said, "We haven't even been the next Stiff Little Fingers yet, Pete's sake." And it's like, so any chance we can do it first before somebody else jumps on our back, you know?
Yeah. How did the relationship with Rough Trade kind of come about? Like, because it's right in the beginning, right? Like, after the first press of the single.
I mean, basically, Gordon, our manager, was traveling to and from London because he was working for a national newspaper at the time. And he was basically just taking boxes of Suspect of Ice over in the front of his car and touting them around record stores and, you know, asking if anybody wanted to buy them. And Rough Trade were among the people who took quite a few of them. So much so that when we came over to do the Tom Robinson tour in 1978, and we'd just been let down by Island Records with regards to a contract, we were looking for a way of releasing a single to go along with the tour, and Gordon happened to be in there buying records, I think, and one of the guys asked, well, you know, what the band were up to, and he said, well, they're coming over to do this tour, but unfortunately, you know, we're not going to have a record out. And they said, well, we put the occasional record out. I think they'd released five singles at that point. So they were very much, you know, they were the London equivalent of Terry Hooley at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, we'd love to put a single out for you. And they put Alternative Ulster out for us to coincide with the TRB tour. And that's really how it started. And, you know, we were convinced that the end of the TRB tour, we'd get, and having been let down by Ireland, we were convinced that, you know, we'll put us in front of an audience and we'll do the job. We were convinced we'd get a record deal by the end of that tour. And that didn't happen. And so we were kind of disappointed. And it was Jeff Travis said to us, look, I remember it as clear as day. We were in the bar at the Hammersmith Odeon after the Tom tour. Well, it was just about to finish. And he basically said, look, you know, we've never made an album. You've never made an album. Why don't we make an album together? And that was how it came about. It was really that. And it was all done on a gentleman's agreement, a handshake. And, you know, we split the profit 50-50. You know, you try and get that deal out of Warner Brothers, see how far you get.
Yeah, exactly. And like you're saying, like, who knows what happens when you get on a major label like Island versus right. something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, when we did eventually sign to Chrysalis, their managing director asked Gordon how many copies of the first album we'd sold. And he told him, I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. But he basically said, oh, we'd have sold double that. And that's, you know, that's obviously sort of major label bravado, but it's also, you know, looking back on it, I'm thinking you probably wouldn't, because we'd have made a different record. You know, we wouldn't have made, it wouldn't have been as raw. It wouldn't have been as unstructured. It would have, you know, they'd have put us in a studio with a proper producer and they'd have ironed out all the rough spots. And, you know, as much as I find, I don't listen to our records at home. I don't know anybody in a band who does listen to their own records, to be fair.
It's terrifying to think about people that do that. Like, you got to be a special kind of psycho to want to listen to yourself
I mean, the only time I listen to them is if we decide to put a song in the set we haven't played in ages. I'm like, how the hell does that go again? And that's the only time I listen to it. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think the rough spots are what give that record its charm. And you know what made it the record that it is, you know. So anyway,
Jake, this has been awesome, and anytime you want to come back and talk more of this stuff, I'd love to talk to you forever.
Well, thank you. It was very detailed. I was like, I feel like I'm 19 again, you know.
It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out of this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front. And everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me, and you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival, and hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.